Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, overclocked GeForce GTX 750 Ti Roundup, DirectX 12. Is it gonna kill Mantle? SSD update, Maxima 6, Asus drops an epic mini ITX motherboard, Kraken G10 R9 G90 water cooling, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 259, recorded March 20th, 2014. DirectX 12, people. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that just makes sense. Save money with Ting, pay only for what you use. Ting doesn't require a contract and offers unlimited devices on one shared plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit twitch.ting.com. That's twitch.ting.com. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly podcast that aims to bring you the best, most informative, most useful, and delightful news about hardware. Mostly we talk about PCs, we love the gaming, and yes, we show some love to the tablets too. And if you may be wondering why our aspirations are high this week, it's because Ryan, Mr. Middle of the Road Podcast, is stuck somewhere at the Game Developers Conference, just a mile from where I'm sitting, while Scott Michaud, news editor, PC Perspective, joins us and has decided to raise the bar of excellence to unprecedented heights. How's that,
expectations.
You wanted high expectations.
There's it's no promise there of actual content.
Well, you know, you got to start somewhere. Then, you know, think about trailers. I mean, when you get a 90-second trailer for a two-hour movie, and all the good scenes are in the trailer. Makes me sad. DirectX 12 this week, Game Developers Conference 2014. What are you more excited about? The DirectX 12 announcements, the OpenGL announcements, the general FURA and excitement, the Unreal Engine. I mean, if you're a developer, all of a sudden Unreal's made it possible for like $19 a month and a tiny percentage of your revenue to actually have access to a world-class engine. I mean, Scott, you're the guest here today. What's got you excited?
I guess we start with Unreal Engine because you kind of led off with it already.
Okay.
They changed their licensing structure a lot, and it's even flexible from there. They talk about it in their FAQ, because I'm not pronounced otherwise. So I don't think anyone does. But I think it's like $19 a month. You can cancel at any time, and when you actually release something, it's 5% of your revenue.
Right.
But then they even say, hey, if you have other plans, like you're, you know, expecting that your 5% of revenue is going to be gigantic, we'll even do other licensing terms where you pay it all up front or whatever, or pay less up front or pay more up front, but less royalty and that sort of stuff. So they're still even then able to basically negotiate with you for what's the best between the two of you guys. However, probably for the people that don't have the legal counsel to do that negotiation, as in the indies, 5% royalty is probably pretty nice. It used to be on UDK 25%, although they'd give you some buffer of nothing, and they would not take off what the App Store takes off. So if you had $100,000 of sales and Apple takes 30%, they would charge you the 25% royalty on this 70,000 minus a 50,000 grace period they give you. So they take 25% off of the 20,000 and from on there. That's not the case in this case. It is 5% from zero, regardless of what Steam takes away. So if you know you sell 100,000 and Steam takes away Apple takes away $3,000, Epic's going to take away $5,000.
Well, I mean, but I mean, it's kind of funny, right? Because one of the things Unreal is, you know, and obviously Unreal on their own blog is perhaps spinning this to their own benefit, as you might expect. But the idea that, you know, we're going to make this engine and these tools, and we're going to make it so easy to make games, you'll be delighted that you're, you know, paying 5% of your revenue, which compared to 25% plus an upfront fee is pretty chill. I mean, it's interesting. They're talking about, like, you know, the C++ code, quote, you can see many new initiatives underway, for example, to support Oculus VR, Linux, Valve, Steamworks, and Steambox. Firefox efforts and deployment of games to web browsers via HTML5. You know, I'll be curious. I have a couple of friends who are pretty serious coders. And one of them was kind of irked because this announcement, which made the idea of developing on Unreal Engine 4 really attractive for him, arrived a couple months after he'd made a major career decision. And he's like, if I'd known this was coming, I could have done a game instead of going to work for actually, you know, a large badass company doing really cool stuff. So, you know, in his case, it's a pretty high class choice, but it's an interesting model for them to employ.
And going beyond that, they're also hosting all the code on GitHub. So as long as you have a subscription, you can always be at their GitHub. So if there is a feature, like, for example, Starsys, and they licensed the latest CryEngine, and because of some AMD, you know, something or other, they decide, we're going to put Mantle in this. So they took CryEngine and they just replaced the renderer and gave it an option to use Mantle directly. In this case, if they would have used Unreal Engine 4, they could then, if they decide to, go back to GitHub and then, you know, say, okay, we're going to commit that back to the community, and the community would then be able to, you know, ruffle through it, and then that would be an option for everyone. So they're even doing a little bit of open source, kind of controlled, because it's only for licensees, which, again, $20 a month. But they're kind of doing a controlled, open source, community-based, which not so big for the publishers, the giant publishers, but for a bunch of small indies being like, hey, I can put this feature in if you can put this feature in, right? And then everyone has it.
Which is a good thing. I mean, just to sort of in terms of like maybe leveling the playing field or making more opportunities or simply spending less internal resources on doing things that are kind of a very hardware back end rather than actually doing things like making more better gaming opportunities, which is kind of like a sophisticated sentence, but maybe not so. Interesting development this week at the Game Developers Conference. Obviously, something that was announced late and kind of exciting was DirectX 12. PC Per live blogged it. I mean, I started taking notes in the middle of that one. And it's kind of funny, right? Because on day one of the Game Developers Conference, the Kronos Group released the OpenGL ES spec, the 3.1 spec. There's a lot going on right now. And a lot of it seems to be involving Microsoft suddenly deciding they need to, cut the overhead, make things more efficient, and kind of give a little better access, you know, to a lower level of the hardware they traditionally have, right? The whole point of DirectX going back to like 95, 96 was to eliminate all the weird little DOS hooks that people were running around Windows. And to a certain degree, it's been pretty good. And it's kind of funny, right? They have some issues with the Xbox One in terms of having a incredibly low core count on the GPU compared to the PlayStation 4. Yep. You know, AMD does Mantle, and Mantle starts gaining some steam, no pun intended, in terms of developers being excited about having lower level access and reducing the CPU overhead for gaming. It's exciting. What do you think, man?
And that's kind of one of the big things too. Actually, after the event, there was another presentation by Kronos Group with NVIDIA talking about reducing driver overhead in OpenGL. I don't know what happened there because no one seemed to have live blogged it. As a matter of fact, I think we're the only ones that live blogged the DirectX 12 one. But it's very interesting in how it works, because one of the key reasons for them doing it right now is that since about Fermi, and the equivalent in AMD structure, they started to become general purpose compute engines using IEEE 754 floating point variables and other types of standardized things. So you don't really need DirectX to be like, okay, NVIDIA, my customer wants a floating point. This is the number. Have whatever is in the back end do it. I don't care. I don't want to see it, but just give me the correct answer back. Well, now it's like, here's a IEEE floating point. Give me a result back. So a lot of those shielding things you did from the developer don't even matter anymore.
Right.
So why do you want to do it if it's only going to make the driver people go insane loading their main thread with checks that the developer does, then the driver does, and the API does. The same check in all three places. So there's a bunch of things where it's like there's no point in doing them anymore. And it's basically coming down to the fact that video cards are gigantic general purpose processing devices with a bit of ASICs and other types of integrated circuits that do, you know, rasterization really quickly and really power efficiently and this, that, and the other thing to make it go quicker. But beyond them, it just goes right through the cores over and over and over again. The vertex shader gets pumped through, then the output gets pumped back through as a pixel shader, then it gets pumped back through, you know. So why would they need to? And that's what their thing is, just if they can cut all that legacy crap off like they're trying to do back in DirectX 10, it's simpler for driver developers. It's simpler for the developers. It's simpler for them.
Right.
It's just a matter of actually getting around to doing it. And I mean,
sorry.
I'm not sure how much of it was Mantle pushing them and how much of it was the conditions that pushed Mantle can push all the other vendors in the same way. Because again, on the hardware side, this change happened like in when Fermi came out, like 2009.
Right.
So this mentality has been around for a while. Just people were like, well, we still have like 50% of people that are still using it, whatever. Well, who's using a high-end gaming PC with a video card that's before Fermi these days? I mean,
I spent a lot of money on it.
As a matter of fact, there's another story that just happened where NVIDIA is deprecating their future driver upgrades for anything before Fermi. They are making a fork and their Forceware 340, and that's going to be maintained through 2016. But all the new features in the main branch are going to be for Fermi and later. And I'm wondering how much of it's, and I actually asked Ryan to ask NVIDIA, but I haven't got a response back from him on it. I'm wondering how much of that's just basically being like, listen, we know what DirectX 12 is going to happen. This is what we're going to care about. The older stuff, it's too old. We don't care anymore. Right. And it's just going to, you know, it's going to prevent us from putting features in the new stuff that we can't put in the old one or vice versa or whatever. So cut it off and have that be that.
It would be a big deal. It would be very, I mean, it would be a very Apple thing to do where like every 3 years, the next generation of the operating system culls all the older hardware off the list. Yeah, I mean,
well, it's actually more like 4 to 5 years, which for video card terms is...
In some ways forever, but in some cases, you know, some people use their cards for much longer than maybe they should. Yeah, given what cards cost, I can see why people do that. I mean, it's interesting, right? They're grouping the pipeline state in state objects to map things to the GPU hardware, better control over graphics memory. Forza said, or the Forza 5 crew said it took 4, quote, man months of efforts to put Core Rendering Engine from Xbox One, Direct 3D 11 to Direct 3D 12. It's going to work across all Microsoft platforms. It's interesting.
And that's and another thing fast. Too is once you cut the CPU overhead and you from, because one thing mobile does really bad is single threaded tasks. It is terrible at that. They hate that. because I mean, it's cheap for them to go and, you know, mirror their core over and over and over again, as long as they have a small enough process node. It's not cheap for them to, you know, increase their single threaded performance by X factor without increasing their power usage by Y factor and their customer complaints by Z factor, right? So you do have that kind of aspect, but I can even see, for example, future web browsers on mobile devices wanting to switch to DirectX 12 to do their, you know, layout and other types of compositing, and depending on the platform, maybe use it for WebGL, because that's a thing with all Windows WebGL these days. It's all actually goes through DirectX.
dun dun dun.
There's other things with that too, but it can really help their power efficiency and give them lower latency on mobile devices, which is something that they really want. So it's not just games we're talking about.
It's going to be interesting. you know, it's going to be interesting to see what goes on with AMD and Mantle in this, although I guess technically they won't really be competing until, what, 2015, 2016?
Yeah, they say they're going to have a preview of something coming out at some time this year. I don't know if it's a tech demo that people can play on their computers or something. I have no clue. But they're targeting game releases in holiday 2015 as having DirectX 12 support. So when you actually go off the shelf and buy a game, or on Steam and buy a game that has DirectX 12 support natively in it, they're expecting it to be the winter 2015 releases.
We wait, ladies and gentlemen, with bated breath. We will not, however, have to wait for the latest news on... actually, it's kind of interesting, right? So we mentioned AMD Mantle. The CryEngine is going to support Mantle. AMD gets another endorsement. Scott, you actually wrote this up for PC Per. So I will stop speaking and let you talk about AMD's latest win on the Mantle development front.
Actually, it's kind of funny because literally the sentence of... AMD Mantle is going to be supported in CryEngine was the only thing I had to go on for that story. But yeah, I mean, they've had some discussion of Mantle earlier, even as far back as the AMD Developer Summit. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, oh, we're kind of interested in it. We're going to, you know, we're testing it out. We can see it. We're not committing to it yet, blah, 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 blah. And then Starsys and was like, hey, so we're, you know, sticking our engine ourselves. And I guess Crytek was like, well, our test goes good. We're doing it. And probably Starsys was like, could have used that programmer somewhere else. But that's kind of how it goes. But yeah, basically the API gets another major engine support. So far that is Oxide Games with mm-hmm. their some sort of strategy game that's going to come out at some point. Strategy engine, I mean. Mm-hmm. At some point, CryEngine and Frostbite. And that's a big, sizable chunk of the gaming industry that will support Mantle. That said, it's in the engine source, just like Linux support has been in Unreal Engine support since, like, I think Unreal Engine 1. So how many licensees have you seen use it? Who knows, right? So we'll have a lot of stuff to go by. Who knows what's going to use it? Crytek could be like, here's the source code. And developers will be like, thanks.
Gotta
and
go.
No keyboard would ever be touched, right?
Right. I don't know. It's gonna. I just want AMD to succeed. Or exceed, for that matter. OpenGL ES 3.1 spec released by the Kronos Group. I have the lines pretty much. I mean, with the Steam OS, the Steam boxes, the Valve pushing, driving, beating Linux gaming forward, probably more than anybody else has in the last decade. Is this going to be a big part of that, the OpenGL ES 3.1 spec, or is this a much broader thing than that?
Well, ES is a quote embedded systems, so it's more for the mobile. So you'd see it more in like Android or other video card developers that can't really keep up with the full specification. Mm-hmm. That said, I mean, on the conference call, Kronos was pretty clear in saying, over time, we have been moving ES specification to be a subset of OpenGL, and we want to expand it to be the full thing. So they are pretty clearly thinking about just giving people who may have not been either ATI or NVIDIA developing video cards since forever, who right. want to have a way in to get into this space with competitive products, kind of giving them an easy on-ramp and then being like, highly goes, have fun, right? Yeah. And again, it comes back to our discussion about DirectX 12 because really, there hasn't been a whole lot of new features coming out in latest versions of DirectX and stuff like that. Because really, there isn't much left to do. There's a Qualcomm announcement of ray tracing and, well, okay, or not Qualcomm, it was MediaTek.
Right.
Announcement of ray tracing and stuff like that. So unless ray tracing gets picked up in, you know, mass form, really, it's just a matter of having as many shader units as possible running as fast as possible and keeping them as loaded as possible. And that's what the APIs have been focusing on. So you can probably kind of see OpenGL kind of slow down a little bit. So it's probably kind of, you know, think of it like an air, a midair like fueling thing where OpenGL is like, okay, ready to dock. There we are, right? So you kind of see it kind of merging a little bit because it's kind of slowing down on the top end, not because of performance slowing down, but because there's not much else but performance to slow down these days.
Going to be interesting. NVIDIA GeForce GTX 1050 Ti Roundup, EVGA Galaxy, and PNY overclocked. I actually have the PNY overclocked 750 Ti in, and it is a delightful little board. Brian got seriously hands-on with this crew, and I'm going to kind of cut to the chase on this one. EVGA was the loudest by 5 decibels, but the fastest and most stable. There's some interesting things going on in terms of the firmware. And performance was pretty solid across all three boards. Two of them got a gold. One of them got a silver. And I'm going to make you go to PCPer.com to get the full details on that one. But generally speaking, this is a amazing card. And it is by far the card to beat right now. In terms of, like, you know, for $150, this is going to give you more joy, I think, out of your gaming environment than anything else you're going to spend that money on. Or maybe I'm just excited because I got to take a look at the benchmarks before and after on one of our low-end systems we had in here.
Installed one over there?
We got one over here, one of the PMY boards, and it's crazy, right? Because it's requiring no additional power. It's a super small card, so it fits great in tiny cases. It's a nice piece of silicon.
Yeah, it's all about that power efficiency, right? I'm not sure why they haven't released the top end parts yet. I'm assuming it's because the chip bigger, they would need smaller process node, but that's beyond the point. But the architecture definitely has really thought about how to make things very power efficient for what you get out of it, rebalancing everything, making it so that way that certain number of shaders are power of 2 to make the logic going into it easier, so you don't have to have as much circuits to drive the circuits, so then you can put more circuits instead of those circuits, right? Mm-hmm. So they've thought about this in a lot of different ways, and it's pretty clear that this is going to be a big thing from a power efficiency standpoint. Top end, who knows? But...
I mean, they're incredibly power efficient cards. And we had a viewer question about this a little later on. I mean, you're talking about NVIDIA's like 300 watt power supply, you're good to go, which is kind of ridiculous considering some of the numbers we were seeing on GPUs in terms of the consumption, the wattage they were hitting. And the overclocked cards, if you know, like on Battlefield 4, you're looking at like a 19% increase over the reference design. For the fastest card in the roundup. That's a big deal to me for another $25 over the $150 for the stock part.
Doesn't one of them require power? I thought one of them required a power connector.
Yeah, at least one or two of them require a power connector, but the little PNY doesn't. In fact, where is it? As I sit here, as everyone watching the video now watches me stare intently trying to find which one has the power connector. So the EVGA has a power connector. And ladies and gentlemen, watching people stare at GPUs in real time. This is really what international communications, actually both the Galaxy and the PNY require a 6-pin power connector. the EVGA and the Galaxy. Then the PNY gets everything over the bus, which is kind of crazy. I mean, you look at like I think it's a 60 watt TDP. Just, man.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. Although if you would tell it to someone from like 2002, they'd be like, 300 watt power supply. Oh no, I have to upgrade. Good?
No. At least it's not upgrading like a 1500 watt power supply.
Yeah, I know. I remember back in the day, people were looking at like, oh my God, 1,000 watt power supplies. They require two plugs. Because they're really kind of two 500s kind of sandwiched together on one thing. Ever remember those?
I inherited a couple of what were at one point super high-end Dell, not quite workstation class machines because they were part of a gaming effort there. But they kind of look like a Cylon from the front, some sort of a combination between a Cylon and the Death Station, and there's a lot of red paint. But they actually have 20-amp hospital plugs on them.
nice.
You know, because the power supplies were ridiculously large and ridiculously inefficient because of the particular era on that. And it was kind of funny to, you know, somebody went to plug one of those in and like, like, it's a 20 amp cord. We don't have one. Use something else. And now you're looking at probably at the 750 Ti three or four times the graphics performance, you know, off of a minuscule amperage load coming out of the wall by comparison. I'm excited for low power computing, mostly because electricity is getting freaking expensive. Speaking of expensive, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Ting. You can save $25 on your first Ting device if you go to twitch.ting.com. I myself am a Ting customer. It's really simple. They are a no BS mobile provider. You know, it's simple, right? They want everything to be clear and upfront and make sense. They want you to save money. Obviously, they're here to make a profit. Ting's a company. They got a profit motive there. But they're only going to ask you to pay for what you use. They don't require a contract. They offer unlimited devices on one shared plan. You know, it's the nationwide Sprint network. Ting is an MVNO. They're a reseller. And it's really good. They got, you know, basically a cut rate on data. So they pass that along to you. So the data cost is going down. You know, if you haven't checked it out, you should take a look at Ting's savings calculator. Take a look at what you're currently paying. Take a look at what you might be paying given your current consumption on Ting. And you might find the difference is rather spectacular. You know, and it's been amazing, right? Watching what's been going on in the mobile sphere as companies like Ting push for lower pricing models. Some of the larger companies are responding by cutting, but I don't think they're cutting twice as close. There's no add-on charges here. You don't get charged for voicemail, for caller ID, for tethering, for hotspot. It's not like, you know what I mean? You're going to pay for your data and then you're going to pay an extra $30 so you connect another computer to your phone. That's stupid. And Ting's not making you pay for that. Their support is awesome. I had to use it once when I was bringing a device onto their plan. And it's really, really slick, right? I said it before, they're contract fee free. There's no early termination fees. They'll give you a credit if you're paying an ETF to come to Ting and an early termination fee. There's no weird line items. It's really clean software. I was looking for a friend of mine trying to find a deal, and I realized that the most frustrating thing about most telephone companies is actually working with the telephone company because they're trying to make, well, it's hard for you to find out what you need to know. Ting.com is not like that. They're pretty simple. They're pretty clear cut. If you can't find it on the web, call 1-855-TING-FTW. I believe that is for the win, anytime between 8 and 8 p.m. You get a real person. They will help you out. They will send you an email to follow up with your questions, or you can go to help.ting.com. And they're really cool. They're really affordable. It's cheap, people. And part of the reason it's cheap is because you buy your hardware. You don't get your hardware costs buried in 3x your hardware costs spread over 24 months. You don't really notice it, right? The whole point of a two-year contract is so you don't notice how much you're sending to the phone company. And Ting's not like that. I'd like to invite you to check out our sponsor, twitch.ting.com. You'll help out the podcast, keep us rolling along, and you might get yourself a fat deal, a delightful deal. Save yourself some money on your mobile plan. Really, seriously, check out the savings calculator, see how much you and your company can save. And this week in Computer Hardware, viewers will save $25 on the first Ting device when you sign up. Just do us a favor, sign up at twitch.ting.com. That is twitch.ting.com. We want to thank Ting for their support of the podcast. Oh my goodness. Bills are paid. Scott, you still with us or you're on screaming to the doors? Have we supported your quest for excellence still intact?
And if you were watching live in the chat room, I made up a tagline. So.
Oh, no. I'm half tempted to open up the chat room again since I basically like swapped browsers mid podcast because Chrome decided to make my life a misery again.
And there's of course it on the screen. Supposed to leave it as an exercise for the live viewers. Come on.
I like it. The one phone company is for the win. Oh my goodness.
As opposed to the other FTW. That's I remember all the Arcos.
Twitter anniversary, you can actually, they put up a special website so you can put your name in or anybody else's Twitter name in and find out what their first tweet was. And I was thinking about, like, you know, when I was first on Twitter, why is everybody typing in obscenities or shorthand for them? And then somebody was like, that's not what that stands for on Twitter. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, for the win, not world. Oh.
Yeah. I thought it stood for for the whales. But I guess
only on the bad
or
days.
Fail the whale.
Twitter. Yeah,
that would work.
Because somebody's
Twitter,
got
failed more whale. Pictures
of whales. Asus Maximus 6 Impact motherboard review. Maury wrote this up for PCPer.com. This is a really nice motherboard. And part of our continuing obsession with Mini ITX hardware, both motherboards and cases. Was Maury on the podcast last night by any chance?
No, he was not. It was just Josh, Allen, and Jeremy, who were on. Okay. Ken, of course, the technical director. Kept, you know,
it's all coming together
voice
now
because no one else is there. But yeah, they talked pretty extensively about it. I'm not too much on motherboards. I'm kind of the type of person that, like, I have so many motherboard failures that I just want one that works in most cases and has the plugs and stuff that I need, and we're good, right? But they're talking about the innovation on this one, and it's like, for example, the I believe they said the power delivery was actually in a riser card to make it that smaller. Because
it's kind of crazy, right? Because if you look at the look at the pictures up on the website, if you scroll down a little bit, you kind of look at the layout of the board, and they seem to try to shove everything into a vertical format to make room for the GPU to sort of hide the memory, you know, so the sort of impact power board there on the side. MSRP is $229
just for power.
Yeah,
just to make it smaller is kind of insane.
That's pretty cool. And the amount of ports that are stuffed into this is kind of ridiculous, right? Because, you know, you're looking at HDMI, a SPDIF out, the ROG connect.
They say six and six for USB, but we can only count four of each. We're not exactly sure where the other ones are.
Are they down on the motherboard?
Well, that'd be kind of weird to have a USB plug in a motherboard, right?
Stranger things will have happened.
Okay, I will give you that.
I take it back. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Two on board,
says
four.
12.
Yeah, two on the board, four on the rear. Four 2.0, four 3.0, and two of them are on the board. So that's probably the jacks to connect to the front of the case. It says it right there in the chart, man. I swear. And now I'm trying to look at the pins on the motherboard so I can figure out where the additional ports are, which is going to make my eyes fall completely out of my face. A riser card for the audio, which is a really nice touch on there. If you look at the side of the case on there, it's a really densely packed case motherboard. It's really densely packed. If you scroll all the way down to the, they've got the reset, like the CMOS reset button on the back of there, the LCD that outputs information on the status of the board, SPDIF out, HDMI. It's just a really nicely laid out board, as long as it doesn't fall apart in extended use. So are you hard on motherboards by accident, or are you just in one of the parts of the country where the electricity is just miserable? Or
I used to have really miserable power, like bad, to the point where you would wake up at night because your computer turned itself on and your clock reset. Uh-huh. I never realized that you can have a, you know, brown or something and that would trigger computer turn on. But apparently that was the case, as was my old house. That since then we moved to a house with better power and have also got a UPS. So haven't had too many problems since then, but even then I don't overclock or anything like that. Use the performance I get, and I'm happy with that. If I absolutely need to get, because the way I look at it is, if I have 35 frames per second or 38 frames per second or 40 frames per second, I don't care that much.
And you're still going to get fragged by an angry 12-year-old that does nothing but play that particular game. Just saying. I'm projecting here. Yeah. You may not get fried by the angry 12-year-olds.
Well, depends on the game. Depends on the game. If you're talking about, like, StarCraft, yeah, I'm probably not the best representation of a good StarCraft player. Some of the mods, yeah. But when it comes to, like, in real tournament, yeah, I'm pretty good at what I do. I don't mean to brag or anything, but yeah, I like those games and I play them frequently. So
cool.
Little pro tips for people who are kind of having problems with certain types of shooters. I like kind of throwing in tips whenever I can into articles or whatever. But if you're having a hard time with sniping or other types of like really precise but slow fire rate shooting, typically you're better off having your mouse aim and having a second fire key somewhere on the keyboard. So that way when you have the crosshair locked up, you press the button on the keyboard because the act of pressing the mouse button actually jiggles the aim just a little bit and can make you miss. So that's one thing I learned when I was playing that Little America's Garmy game back in like 2003. You will notice in that case, I had probably about a 10-15% increase in accuracy on their little training mode just by having my fire key be a keyboard button. Other kind of little interesting things like that.
Nice. Corsair Hydro Series 875 liquid CPU cooler review. This was interesting, actually. I was kind of excited reading this one, mostly because Maury comes right out at the very beginning. He says, you know, his performance surprised him. He's tested quite a few Corsair all-in-one units. He had some expectations of how this cooler should perform going into the review. However, the fact that it had such a low operating noise level combined with its ability to almost match the performance of the Corsair H100i unit across the board is an impressive achievement. Corsair definitely has a high-performance unit in the 875. And it's kind of nice to see, for once, somebody going, hey, you know, this pre-assembled water cooling unit is actually quieter than what we've been hearing lately. $85 at Newegg, $82 at Amazon. Are you running water cooling on any systems, or are you sticking to air cooling at this point?
Again, I'm one of those boring people that uses stock everything. I know it's kind of bad, but
I can't say that I'm a fan of stock CPU coolers. Like, it's one of the things I will, you know, if I'm building a super cheap machine and there's a stock CPU cooler, I'll use that just to hit a price point. But that's one of the first things I'll upgrade just to hear less fan noise.
Again, I'm one of those types of people that kind of uses my actual computer as utility. When it comes to actually seeing stuff, I mean, like a couple weeks ago, we showed that stack cooling unit where it was 3-6 copper pipes that was being used as passive cooling system, and stuff like that's cool and would be awesome to do it myself. But when it comes to, you know, I have this amount of budget, I'm like, I could buy a better video card. I just don't need to have stock cooling. I wear headphones, right? So
point taken.
And that's it with me. I can definitely see why people would want to do it, either for home theater PCs or for audio recording devices, or just because they want to play with their speakers and not hear every once in a while, right? So that's, you know, what they do. I'm not too good on speaking on it personally, but yeah, it is quite awesome, right?
No, it's much simpler than, you know, doing something I did in a past life, which is using a car radiator for liquid cooling. So I wanted all of the thermal mass to dissipate.
Oh, I saw one guy use a fridge unit. He got his what the?
No, I was going to say, you know, I've experimented some with that too, but it never worked quite as well as I wanted it to. And there were issues with condensation on the motherboard that I don't like to think about even 10 years later.
Oh, yeah, that could be problematic.
It could be expensive, yeah, is what it can be.
That guy, I guess, had some good luck because he, I think his startup temperature was like -35 Celsius, and it was like running at zero. Mind you, that was on like a Pentium 3, I believe. So it was quite a while away, but I mean, hobbyists, they're going to be hobbyists no matter what year you're in, right?
And no, it's, yeah, sometimes you just got to go for all the stupid.
Well, it's not even just all the stupid. It's just like, it's awesome. You take that time to do that project for something that you know, want a quiet PC, you want a cool PC, you want to overclock it to say you overclocked it, because at that time no one made a faster processor. So guess what? You have the fastest processor right now just because it's running way over its specifications. that's awesome, right? So, and also they're talking about this cooler having kind of a the little micro fins on the copper. I don't know if there's a picture on it somewhere, but yeah, that's what it was. Wow, you're awesome on that. But yeah, so apparently they kind of revisited that design. They were talking in the podcast last night, and I didn't exactly hear exactly what they're talking about, but of an earlier design where they would open it up and see it was just all corroded. But yeah, apparently they're, and that's kind of what Corsair usually does, is they release a, you know, few products, and they carefully think about each one and being like, how can we save money on this? How can we make this better? How can we, you know, solve this problem for the user? And they will go to some pretty weird lengths to make it better for their users. And that's kind of awesome, isn't it?
It's extremely awesome. So earlier this year, or I should say earlier when the R9 290, 290X came out last year, actually, not earlier this year. One of the issues
when you consider availability, or you consider.
Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. And availability is still difficult, but I promise we wouldn't talk about anything involving Bitcoins today. But there were issues with.
He did some mining stuff on the 750 Ti. So.
Don't do it. It's kind of funny, right? So the R9 290X came out, benchmarking starts. Reference cards were kind of troublesome, basically with issues with overheating and clock speeds. And what you're looking at right now is probably Ryan's hands, if I'm not mistaken, installing a new NZXT Kraken G10, basically water cooling an R9 290, and it's pretty badass because when you look at the results on this, the reference card's running like 48. Oops, that's the sound levels. I'm laughing, right? So the sound levels, you know, drop from like, you know, 48.5 to 33.7 decibels, but the temperature comparison is ridiculous in terms of the two of these. So you're looking at like 90 plus degrees Celsius on the stock cooler, on the reference cooler, dropping down to 50 degrees.
I think there was only like what, between load and idle, only like a degree of difference or something like that.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, you know, you're looking at stuff like running Metro, you know, to have the drop on some of these is pretty incredible. You know,
and it's only like $30, although you have to have a, your own water cooling thing. It's pretty interesting. And the funny thing was, you see these amazing results that Ryan and Ken actually got when they assembled it. They found that they were limited by the VRM temperature. The VRM temperature was getting way too high. Otherwise, they would have overclocked it even further. Wow. It's getting to the point where, like, the power going in, it's, you know, little components were getting too hot to deliver the power for the GPU that was being adequately cooled. So they're saying, like, because this is one of those generic ones where you can, you know, assemble on a R9 290, which is probably going to benefit great from water cooling, but you can put it on, like, a, I think even GeForce, some of the cards, too. So it's one of those... mix and match once, but to have enough cooling that you would then be like, in order to get more performance out of it, I have to cool that too, right? So
right.
If you're the type of person that want to hack, you can have that as being your starting point, and then, you know.
Well, that's why you need the car radiator, so you have enough, you know, coolant to deal with the processor and the GPU, or the multiple GPUs, and cooling the hard drives, and maybe putting a place for the cat to sit when the cat's hot on August afternoons. Interesting news from Intel: Haswell E8 Core Extreme Edition with DDR4 memory. So this is one of the things that came out from Intel at Game Developers Conference this week. So I like the thing that Intel pointed out. Since the first or the initial release of the first Extreme Edition processor 2003, which was a Pentium 4 part, quote, Intel has moved from 1.7 million transistors to over 1.8 billion on Ivy Bridge E. Today, Intel officially confirms the Haswell E is coming. It's going to be 8-core desktop processor. It's going to be the first desktop platform supporting DDR4 memory. It's going to have a new X99 chipset from obviously Intel. And all we know about it is that it's going to be out the second half of 2014. 10 SATA 6G ports, 6 USB 3.0 ports, which is awesome. I will build a freaking server on it already. Mother of all free NAS boxes, and probably an M tag to go with it. So I went with baby breath. That's kind of the theme of the evening. What do you think of the SSD pricing? Like 1 terabyte. Samsung 840, 1 terabyte Evo is down to $469.
It's insane. I mean, to get that much storage for that, I mean, so I'm going to level with you guys. I think it was around 2010 that I bought my SSD. It was a 256 gigabytes. It was a Crucial C300 when they kind of first came out, the first couple waves of it. And I think I was out about $700 tax and shipping in for a quarter of a terabyte. And works great for me, but, you know, you're kind of hitting the wall, so you're bouncing some things in other drives. To right. Now see 4 times the storage for cheaper is...
painful.
Not quite painful. I'm not the type of person to be like, oh, you had such a good deal. Why are you so awesome? You know, but I mean, it is definitely a like a couple months ago, we ran an article being like, this is a great time to buy SSDs. And really, the price hasn't dropped too much since then, but you're under 50 cents a gigabyte. That is, I mean, buying hard drives back in like 2004 was like $1 a gigabyte.
I have a 50 megabyte XL hard card that's still floating around my life in various corners. It kind of, you know, I'll bring it in for something. You know, it was $500. My first 500 megabyte hard drive was $500. My first, you know, I laugh, but it's like my first 5 gigabyte hard drive, $500. I mean, yeah. I was kind of giggling because the other day I was looking at the 3 terabyte versus the 4 terabyte Western Digital Reds, and I was laughing because, you know, one was 0.0, so one was 4.5 cents per gigabyte, and the other one was 4.6 cents per gigabyte, and I just started laughing because, you know, we look at like 50 cents a gigabyte, which is a huge number in terms of being incredibly inexpensive for solid state drive technology, but it's still, you know, 10 times as expensive as rotating media. As expensive again, rotating media.
And again, being, well, yeah, but being within one order of magnitude of rotating media is something that is definitely make them sweat a little bit, right? Because, yeah, I mean, there is some other, you know, advantages of rotating media when it comes to certain applications, but storage is, or capacity is, slowly becoming one of the ones that's just not, you know, worth it so much anymore, especially since, I mean, you can buy external hard drives that are USB 3 that perform just about as good as when it was inside the computer. And then you have a SSD to go along with it that's, you know, a terabyte in size for, you know, $450 or $470. We're sitting in good times right now for storage.
No, absolutely. Right? No, it's pretty awesome. I'm also laughing because I got a new Synology box in for testing, and it's got 24 gigabytes of drives inside of it. I was just like, excuse me.
Terabytes, yeah.
Thank you. 24 gigabytes. Not so impressive. 24 terabytes, impressive. You know, and it's amazing the amount of storage you're getting. So I remember the first time we built a 12 terabyte NAS box, and I thought that was all the storage in the world. And now I'm looking at like double that out of a simple, relatively, you know, incredibly, just a power sipping, an incredibly low power enclosure. And it's incredibly easy. It's basically an appliance. I don't have to do a lot of high-end maintenance on it. I like cheap storage, especially when it makes my machine faster. So, you know, it makes me wonder how much prices might drop between now and the end of the year. Probably not as much as I want without like a die shrink or something on the memory side, but we wait with bated breath. I'm going to see if I can say that two more times in the show before I start screaming. Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv is the email address. We love your questions. No mail, Patrick. Says Alpha 1 Omega. Apparently they are on total overload in there. We're going to do a couple fast questions real quick. We got an email from Patrick. Says, hi, Ryan. Hi, Patrick. Question, will a Shuttle XPC SH87R6 with 300-watt power supply be enough to handle the GeForce GTX 750 Ti if I pair it with a 54-watt Core i3 or an 84-watt Core i5 with two sticks of memory and an SSD for hard drives? No CD-ROMs. Theoretically, the total power usage should be less than 200 watts even with the Core i5. I'm looking to build a physically small, respectable gaming PC. Is the power supply good enough, or is it safer to get the 500-watt model? And it's kind of funny. 300 watts is the recommended power supply or minimum power supply per NVIDIA. If you want to, I would feel comfortable going with that. I tend to buy a slightly larger power supply that I think I'll need to give me some more headroom. But in theory, you should be good to go with a 300-watt power supply, especially if it's a solid brand. And
there is a big difference between a 300-watt power supply and a 300 watts. You probably know a lot about this, about the audio gear when they have their, peak versus RMS voltage or wattage, right? Yeah. So you know from the past, 30 years exactly how many ways they can mess with those numbers to make it seem as big as possible, just as long as you don't, blow the speakers or the tube under warranty.
Well, it's funny, right? Because, a bunch of people have done, there's just, $15 to $20, class T or tripath amplifier that's sold on Amazon for like $15 to $20. And, it's a 20 watt amplifier, but when you get into actual real world performance, the distortion is so high by 8 watts, it starts to become physically unusable. And by the time you turn the volume all the way up, you're basically listening to something that sounds like a fuzz box pedal with your music running through it. So yeah, a quality power supply, bronze, silver, platinum, reputable manufacturer, spend more on your power supply than you think you should, because it actually has a more dramatic impact on the performance of everything inside of your system than you may realize. That's a big deal. Dreamscapes is in the chat room. Says, Patrick, I work on AutoCAD and Photoshop. What kind of processor do you recommend? 4770K, 4820K, 4930K, which motherboard to accompany? I'm going to step away from the motherboard conversation right now, because for me, a lot of it's like, how many USB 3.0 ports you need? Do you need Lightning for some particular reason? How big of a motherboard, are you willing to get? ATX, mini ITX, some of the stuff that's going on. We've talked about a bunch of great motherboards in the last couple months. I will say, throw as much processor as you can at it if you're doing a lot of serious AutoCAD work or Photoshop work. But memory is going to be much more critical. Running your primary applications off of SSD, an SSD scratch disk becomes really interesting if you're working with really huge Photoshop files. But, if I had a choice between going from a 4770K to a 4090-30 or doubling my RAM, I'd probably double my RAM in a heartbeat before I did that.
Although I'm pretty sure the 4820K and the 4930K is Ivy Bridge E, which means that you can install more memory. I believe Haswell limits you at 16 gigs, 32 gigs if you have 8 gig DIMMs, I believe.
Which starts to...
Good?
No, I say which starts to make memory seem expensive again.
Yeah. Because I know that I have... I went from a... the i7-920, and I bought a big pack of 4 gigabyte DIMMs of memory, 32 gigabytes in all. And I installed them all to, installed 24 gigabytes of it, which was maxed out for it, to use it. And turns out that I didn't like it, so I did pop out half of them. Otherwise, the computer would just randomly shut itself off, every couple of days. But then I ended up going to the Ivy Bridge unit because eventually the computer just entirely crapped itself out. So I now I have 16 gigabytes in there, and it can go up to 32 gig, but not with the sticks. I have to go and buy other sticks to do it with 8 gig chips. Yeah. And you'd be surprised how often you actually run up against those limits. There's been... Again, as you can probably see, there's like monitors all around me. I do Photoshop and I do that corner sort of professional application stuff. And you're just having web browsers. You can see the usage go up to like, you know, 13 gigabytes, 14 gigabytes, 15 gigabytes.
Right.
And you don't seem to be really doing anything, right? So, yeah, definitely get the RAM. But the main thing would be, if you're deciding between those processors, find one that has a lot of RAM expansion. See the ones that have the most number of slots that you can fill up because, well, again, there's some problems of, you know, you may not be able to fill up all of them, and I don't know which processors are known, you know, bad for that. But
It's, you're looking at 4770K caps out at 32 gigabytes, the 4820K and the 4930K cap out of 64 gigabytes. So if you want all of the memory, go for one of the more expensive processors.
Because even if you only have half of them filled up, you can then have 32 gigabytes, which is the max of the other guy, and you spent, you know, you still have another double room expansion. Depends on how much the processor difference is in cost, but going from the top of Haswell to the bottom of Ivy Bridge E, you'll probably want to go for a ladder to get more RAM options upgrading in the future. Other than that, I mean, yeah, getting all the processor is great, but then again, if you're seeing like 5% or 10% increase in performance, is it necessarily worth the extra, you know, however many $100 that specific model is? Unfortunately, I don't have any of the prices in front of me to see whether it's good or not, but probably go for the slash E version of it. So in that case, Ivy Bridge E, to get more memory options in the future if you can afford it.
Right.
If you can, you know, put up with it, then you may want to save a little bit of money, but probably not. However, I wouldn't necessarily go above that unless you know that you really want the most CPU ever for anything at all times.
Well, I mean, it's funny, right? Because we work with huge videos, and we work, you know, we make a living editing video here, right? And you know, it's crazy when we sort of, you know, moved from, you know, some, basically we moved to you know, first to Adobe Premiere and then Adobe Premiere and a bunch of house built systems that doubled the amount of available memory. It was spectacular what it did for rendering times, what it did for how fast our editors could work. And it's amazing because people get so obsessed with processor, they tend to, you know, not realize that the processor only works as fast as you can pump data to it. And if you're constantly moving stuff back and forth out of main system memory into a scratch disk, you waste a lot of time basically waiting for bits to show up and get processed and then move back somewhere else. So, oh my goodness.
And then again, that matters on whether you're able to keep the video in contiguous order, right? Because if you're doing straight reads, hard drives these days are pretty fast. Now, if you're starting to edit them, then you're going to start being like, I can load this chunk really fast. However, there are about, you know, 3,000 of them for my video file. So then you're going to see an SSD want to help you on that. But,
well, more SSDs, more memory, and don't forget to defrag your traditional hard drives. That's all I'm going to say. Scott, man, thank you so much for joining us this week on Twitch. Anything exciting at PC Per you can talk about, or do you have to remain silent until Ryan's?
Not so much about that, actually. It's, we're basically in the middle of a bunch of game developer conference news. Probably the majority of the announcements has been done. However, I mean, like I said, the live blog today earlier was ridiculously popular. We had our chat room, you know, flood to like 750 people coming in. You know, a bunch of other fun things like that, a lot of viewers for it, but we're going to have a little bit of announcements, I guess, coming forward, I think. And then after that, it's probably going to be a little while of digesting stuff. And knowing our site, probably a video card review or two. I don't know, maybe. I don't know. But
it must be Tuesday. There's another video card review. PCPro.com is the place to find Scott. He is the news editor there. He works alongside Ryan Shrouts and Alan Malvantano and the rest of the crew. We had actually a lot of fun on Dytrion a couple weeks ago. A bunch of the developers from FreeNAS actually came in and kind of did a secondary build with us. Jordan Hubbard, who's the project lead for FreeNAS, he's CTO at IX Systems, one of the co-founders of FreeBSD. And talking with him about his years at Apple was kind of a trip. We did an interview with him on that on Techzilla. But oh my goodness, we got to geek out on DIY. NAS software. I love FreeNAS so much, and I love it even more. But dietrying.com is a website for that one. I just wanted to throw a pitch out for that. And again, Scott, thank you so much for joining me today. That was super awesome.
And, no problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
That's the Scotty Show.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.